Hello.
Hey, is this Mark Miller?
Yeah, Eric.
Yes, it is.
How you doing?
Pretty good. Very happy to be talking with you.
Same here.
Are you all set and well positioned and good to go?
Yeah. We're taping this. Is that right?
Yep. We're doing an audio recording, and I only do video when necessary. So this is not. It's a radio. It's internet radio, anyway.
All right, great.
So I would like to welcome to Planet Waves FM Professor Mark Miller from New York University. Mark Crispin Miller, known to most people. Mark, I'm so happy to have you on the program. Thank you for taking the time.
I'm delighted to talk to you.
This is probably the world's only astrology investigative reporting podcast where everyone in the audience is familiar with the ideas of Marshall McLuhan, because we've had Eric McLuhan, Marshall's son, and Andrew McLuhan, his grandson, on the program so many times, I may hold the world record. We even had them on the program on the same day, two separate interviews a few years back. So we have a media-literate audience, and you are, if I'm not mistaken, you're in the media ecology, used to be called speech and communications in the old days.
Actually, the days when it was known as media ecology are also in the past. When I was hired by Neil Postman in 1997, the program was indeed a program in media ecology, based on McLuhan's ideas, about the significance and influence of media in culture, throughout history. Mm-hmm. But after he died, in the early years of the century, the program began to change radically. Mm-hmm. It became a much larger department, kind of a more inchoate department. Mm-hmm. It became the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication, which really kind of includes everything.
Yeah.
And it became more theoretically inclined and therefore more academic and less attuned to communicating to a larger public, whereas I'd been hired in part because of my status as a public intellectual, a vanishing breed. Neil Postman considered himself a public intellectual as well.
Fair assessment.
So, Yeah, I'm still in that department, but I'm kind of a minority of one.
Yeah, I'll say. So we can talk more about. I'll introduce you too before we play this recording. One place I'd like to jump right in, and I want to quickly go to the propaganda model of the media that you have, and we're going to look at a bit from the New York Times. But the thing that I have been very eager to have a real conversation about with someone who will know what I mean is that this whole COVID phenomenon that we have witnessed is taking place under full digital conditions. And that everything about this whole thing, and I can rattle off a quick list, is the one common thread of everything is digital technology.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
Can I read off a couple?
Yeah, go. Please do.
Feeds that are algorithmic. Everything is pushed by algorithm. The in silico theoretical computer file virus MN908947.3 being searched for by a computer digital polymerase chain reaction test, which is a computer with an IP address on the internet. All news coming through Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, just about. All the newspapers having become digital entities pushed through Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The rapid emergence of the surveillance state with apps and apps and tracing applications and COVID passes, Empire passes, Google passes. The push toward telemedicine. Big tech is now, we're now getting it revealed to us that, really, what we really want to do is have all medicine be algorithmic and conducted on the internet. And essentially all this being part of a global takeover by big tech, in my opinion, my documented opinion, all being this wide encompassing transformational, not content oriented, but medium oriented, environment oriented transformation of full digital conditions. And what you get is COVID. Now, this hit me on the head when I did an article about the Woodstock Festival, which was conducted during the middle of the Hong Kong flu, where 150,000 people were already said to have been killed by a communicable virus. And without digital conditions, everyone piles into a farmer's field amidst the mud, which is really cow shit, and mud and rain, and risking getting struck by lightning, sharing bottles of Coke, passing joints back and forth, and having sex and swimming in ponds. And no one even knew about the Hong Kong flu.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So
well, I'm staggered by your overview. I think it's absolutely correct, and a, you know, a very very fertile suggestion. You know, on the one hand, what we have is a technological communication system of unprecedented sophistication and reach. Right, it's a global phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So it represents, you know, the ne plus ultra of technological sophistication and innovation, right? So it's very, very advanced. You might say it's highly civilized or hyper-civilized, but it's at the service, paradoxically, of creating a kind of neo-feudal world order that is, you know, beyond regressive. What we have is a tiny, tiny cast of multi-billionaires who have global control, global reach, who are demonstrably working through that very system, the one that you just described. They're using that system to create a world in which there are many, many fewer people than there are now, and in which the surviving remnant of humanity will be essentially programmed to serve their masters, right? And they will be subject to a kind of surveillance vastly more exquisite, far more total than anything that George Orwell could ever have imagined.
Or the Stasi, Germany, nothing like that.
Yeah, nothing. I mean, they would all be on their knees. Well, not Orwell. Orwell would be running away as fast as possible. But, you know, the Stasi, you name it, you know, the Gestapo, all those extremely efficient organizations are primitives compared to what they have now, and it doesn't even really involve much of a human police force, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is a digital system. It is, you know, Foucault's panopticon, but you know, just, I mean, immeasurably more sophisticated and harder to deal with than anything we've seen before. And it raises a question that always comes up when we talk about resistance and opposition and so on, is how do you organize in a goldfish bowl? You know, it's really a challenge.
Yeah, and how do you push back against all of this, where all they need to do is turn up the volume?
Yeah, well, ain't that the truth?
And you're drowned out.
You know, well, yes. I mean, every advantage that they have is, you know, nothing new. You know, every advantage in itself is nothing new. The ability to turn up the volume. I mean, we saw this, you know, in World War One. Everybody was completely permeated with this atrocity propaganda, describing these brutal German soldiers impaling babies on bayonets and, you know, crucifying Allied soldiers and cutting the breasts off of Red Cross nurses. This stuff was all made up. It was a fabrication. People were reading it, hearing it, seeing it everywhere they turned. You know, and a few, I think it was a quintet of extremely famous and well, you know, accomplished reporters went over to Belgium to see with their own eyes what was happening, and they all reported, you know, each to his own newspaper, that they saw nothing to bear out these propaganda claims. You know, the Prussians were fairly ruthless, but there was none of this slaughter. It was all made up. And the readers of those, you know, respective journalists picked up from them the fact that all the stuff people were hearing was untrue. What difference did it make, right? I mean, it's like, you know, trying to resist a tidal wave with an umbrella. You can't really do it. Well, now they can turn up the volume far more readily, you know, and with vastly more catastrophic consequences. I mean, I think that this injection program is pure evil, you know. I think its purpose is not to they even admit that the purpose of the program is not really to immunize anyone against COVID-19, but only, they say, to make the symptoms less severe. But it's already killed thousands of people that we know of, which may represent as much as 1% of the actual total.
Right.
Millions more are being seriously injured, you know, neurologically, cardiologically, their vascular systems. And it doesn't matter how graphic the image you may put up on, you know, Facebook, and then they'll take it right down. It doesn't matter so much, I'm qualifying this, it doesn't matter so much that people are coming out with contradictions that are extremely compelling, because they still do have that ability to turn up the volume. But I want to say just one last thing on this subject, and that is that what we're living through now, you know, if we're lucky enough, is quite like what happened toward the end of the Vietnam War, when no matter what, you know, people saw on TV or heard on the radio or read in their newspapers, the casualty rate for Americans serving in that war was so high. So many people, so many families in this country knew someone or had a loved one who didn't come home at all, or who came back destroyed in one way or another. That toll was so great that it was ultimately impossible for any propaganda drive to white it out. Couldn't do it. So they had to end the war. And they did. It wasn't the, you know, those of us who marched against it, you know, if anything, those marches just pissed people off. It was the casualty rate. That's a fact. And now we're going through something much like it. Only now it's many countries, because this is a global thing. And it raises the really interesting question as to what is going to happen when, you know, I mean, push is now coming to shove. I think they've pretty much injected all the people who are willing to be injected or who feel they have no choice. And now they're starting to get tough. You know, Macron has really, you know, pulled out all the stops. It is a biofascist state. The unvaccinated are quite comparable to the Jews in Hitler's Germany. It's becoming explicit. The pushback in France has been dramatic and extremely encouraging. But one wonders, you know, given what you've so ably invoked in describing this digital penumbra, you know, all around the planet, one really wonders, you know, what's going to happen. I personally believe that what they're trying to do is so grandiose and inhuman and insane and evil, you know, that I think they can't succeed. But whether, you know, we can minimize the damage and reclaim some kind of a human future, you know, with something like the culture that we used to have, you know, I can't say. I'd like to know what you think.
Right. If I hadn't spent so much time talking to Eric McLuhan and Andrew and reading Marshall, I would be completely lost. And I'm sure you, among those few people who I just mentioned, also can understand why, because what we're experiencing are the transformative effects of a new medium and the war that comes with it. Right? There's always a world war or some massive war when there's this expansion of the nervous system. And it is not merely that the news moves my Twitter, whereas the Woodstock Festival site had a couple of phone lines coming in, and nobody really saw a newspaper unless you were in the main office and somebody gave you a muddy copy of the Times Herald Record. We are transformed people because of the digital environment. To me, it feels like people are wandering around in Bardo wondering whether they're even alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so any reference to the body can easily be persuasive, as the body is nothing but a disease vector.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
this
so
is what
true.
They're essentially saying.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's really right. The body is a disease vector.
And nothing else, right? It's not, it has no other purpose.
That's
essentially,
right.
Essentially.
That's right.
I mean, not to put too sharp of a point on it, but how are they otherwise convincing 18-year-olds, none of whom died of whatever this COVID thing is, and whatever it is, nobody's got a case of MN908947.3. So that's what they're testing for. How are they convincing 18-year-olds? Well, they're scaring the shit out of them, and they're all digital natives. Their concept of their body, they don't know what to do with a young woman on a date. Now, I mean, feminism has had an influence on this, and if you smile at a girl, you're a rapist and all this stuff. But I think it's far more pernicious than that. Nobody knows what to do with their body.
Yes. Wow. That's so suggestive. I don't know where to begin to answer it. I mean,
we got time.
Well, go
hopefully
ahead.
We'll live a while.
Well, let's start with your aside about feminism and the demonization of the libidinous male, right?
Becomes allegedly a predator. The allegedly libidinous
allegedly.
Predatory male.
Exactly. It is a completely unerotic evocation, and this raises the important point that woke ideology is a crucial component of what we're living through. It's not just an accident.
No,
that the so-called left, which I no longer recognize, has become a kind of woke militia, because woke ideology is profoundly anti-sexual and is really at the service of a eugenicist elite whose goal is to reduce the global population by billions. This is something that puts Hitler in the shade. Bill Gates has been very carefully schooled in how to come across as benign. This guy is a complete sociopath. If you read anything about him, and people don't read books so much because that involves finding an actual tangible object
and
holding
still,
it in your hands
for 20
minutes writing
at a time.
In the margins.
Yeah, that thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, those rectangular objects that fill things that were once called libraries. I don't want to get too curmudgeonly here, but the fact is that if you read anything about Gates as he was and still is, you find that he doesn't have an altruistic bone in his body. Mm-hmm. And if you can manage to, study the Gates Foundation at all impartially, you find that it's basically a means of increasing his wealth. That he has, I don't think he's made a single donation that doesn't pay off for him in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And in this regard, he's exactly like his role model, John D. Rockefeller, who was the first, you know, to run up against the federal antitrust machine, and he lost. But then he, you know, started the Rockefeller Foundation to sanctify his image, abetted by, you know, Ivy Lee, his propaganda genius employee, who came out with all those preposterous photos of the old man handing dimes to little girls. You know, I say they were preposterous, but they worked. They worked. You know, so people now saw this ruthless monopolist.
Yeah.
Who had lately, you know, ordered the slaughter of all those people in Ludlow, Colorado. He stank to high heaven, but all it took was, you know, a steady rinsing in the waters of propaganda, and he emerged, you know, baptized anew as this saintly old character whose foundation was doing great things. I mean, this all sounds familiar because it's exactly what Gates did, although I think he came out ahead in his you know, confrontation with the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
The terms of that settlement are still unknown. At any rate, you know, Gates now wears those pastel sweaters and flaps his hands around and
mm-hmm.
acts like the kind of saintly nerd who cares about, you know, the benighted peoples of the dark continent. I mean, all the imagery is so, you know, flagrantly racist and patronizing and horrific too, because we see all these images of Gates grinningly administering oral vaccines to African babies. You know, it makes me want to puke when I see these things, but you know, most people see what they want to see, you know, which is the basis of effective propaganda, so they buy this, you know, they buy this. But if you pay close attention to what Gates himself has actually said publicly, and he's soft-pedaling it, you realize that he's proposing to use vaccines, among other tools, to reduce the global population by, 10 to 15%. You know, this was in a TED Talk in 2010. He's flapping his hands around. He sounds like Kermit the Frog. And, you know, you're so kind of dazed by his performance of you know, benevolence, that you don't actually work out the numbers. You know, 10 to 15% of the global population is a significant number of
people. About a billion people right now, at least.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that makes Hitler look like a piker. You know,
mm-hmm.
Stalin, Pol Pot. They, you know, these guys are, you know, small potatoes. Gates and okay, then you do a little more reading. And by the way, Eric, as you know, the internet is a double-edged sword, because it does make it much easier for us to locate all kinds of information that, you know, 30 years ago we would have had to go to some library somewhere, or
yeah.
you know, take a plane and interview somebody who witnessed something.
Yep.
Now you can find all kinds of stuff. All right, so you can find quotes from Ted Turner, who is also a rabid eugenicist, but he doesn't have the chops that Bill Gates now has as a kind of, you know, persuader. Ted Turner is much more rough-edged, you know, and
mm-hmm.
outspoken and, you know, candid. And he has said outright that he thinks the global population should be reduced by 80 to 95%, you know. Now, we're talking about, you know, a staggeringly high toll that makes him, at least in his thinking, a criminal whose sin is sort of beyond computation, you know, or assessment. 80 to 95% of the global population. Well, Gates is actually on the same page with him.
Right.
It's been scrubbed from the internet, okay, because of Gates' power, but he has said, he has been known to say that his ideal is the golden billion. That is to say, the ideal world population number is 1 billion. So that's just enough people to serve their needs, right? If they've been suitably chipped and, you know, invaded and manipulated, right? So we're talking about an elite whose criminality is sort of almost beyond understanding. And I think more and more people are starting to become aware of this, right? They're mostly on the right, you know, interestingly.
So-called right, yeah.
The so-called right, exactly.
Previously identified as the conservatives.
Yeah, that's right. The whole left-right thing, as you are well aware, is meaningless now. It means nothing.
I mean, I figured that out. Like, the floor fell out when I used to be a fan of Rachel Maddow, charming,
okay,
and you know, appealing in a certain way, and all she was ever doing was stumping for the government. And I was always suspicious of the whole MSNBC phenomenon because I've covered General Electric since 1991. So I know what's in my previous specialty before I, you know, became one of the leading authorities in minor planet discoveries and their astrology was I have tens of thousands of pages out of the files of General Electric in my files. I know what they do. I know their propaganda model, and they hired Walter Cronkite to tell exposed workers exposed to PCBs that PCBs are harmless, they're no more toxic than table salt. That's what he said in one particular propaganda GE industrial film featuring Walter Cronkite after he retired from what was his network again? I don't even remember. CBS.
The network of Edward R. Murrow.
Yeah, the guy crying, taking his eyeglasses off and crying when John F. Kennedy was assassinated and all this stuff. Stumping for these chemicals that just basically have cut a swath of death through humanity and the environment. And so that's the GE propaganda model. I know who they are. And so it always made me nervous that somebody as articulate as Keith Olbermann was being paid by GE. And that doesn't even include all the pharmaceutical companies feeding in. And this comes to the question of ownership, right? When we talk about a propaganda model of the media, back when I was editing the Student Leader News Service and hanging out with my friend who was the editor of the New Liberation News Service, we were reading all the stuff saying the entire media was being concentrated in basically into 10 companies. And this is 91.
Okay. We were on the same page at the time because it was, a few years later, I was asked to edit that series of special issues of The Nation, the national entertainment state, and that was our mission. That is to say, to alert the public to the fact that the media was becoming increasingly concentrated, and it was now five companies, and we devised these really impressive glossy fold-out charts of ownership. We did four issues. The first one was who owns the network news. So you and I were allies in that struggle, which was, of course, quixotic, as so many worthy struggles are, because, you know, we obviously didn't succeed in reversing that trend, you know, which, you know, I guess started under Reagan and then was consummated under Clinton. You know, what's the difference between the two parties? I can't see it. So you've brought up something crucial, which is the unification of the media, you know, in a way that's not supposed to be possible in the United States. I mean, ideally speaking, that's a totalitarian model. So, you know, the media under Dr. Goebbels was based on the premise that one needs, and I'm quoting him more or less, you know, ostensible diversity disguising an actual uniformity. So you've got this, you know, dazzling array of different possibilities, you know, hundreds of cable channels. I'm not talking about Germany then, now I'm talking about us now.
Yeah.
You know, there were all kinds of publications and movies and so on, radio bulletins and radio shows under the Nazis. So it looked to the average good German like they had many choices. And likewise for us, right, we think that there's just this, you know, it sort of infinite range of choices for news and or entertainment. I mean, just pick up your cell phone and start to search. But there is an actual uniformity there, and your opening riff also relates to this, you know, that it's all filtered through a very few corporate portals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And each of them is very, very stringently policed to keep out anything that contradicts the official narrative, right?
Yep.
Now,
including
people
go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, you talk to any Russian or you talk to any Chinese. I have a lot of Chinese students.
Yeah.
You know, NYU has more Chinese students than any other school in the U.S. And they're all, you know, fairly intelligent about all this. It's no secret to anyone in those places what is actually going on, because they don't live under the pretense of democratic, you know, of the First Amendment,
right,
and so on. So Americans have been slower to see that under corporate control, the media here is really no different from the media under Hitler. In effect, it's no different.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's only, again, conservatives, or I should say it's primarily conservatives who will see this, because they're, you know, sort of innate distrust of government is serving them well now, because they've been vindicated. You know, I now think, I used to just roll my eyes when I heard this. I now believe that the government has been intent on seizing everyone's guns for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and if I were a Rockefeller or, you know, one of those people, I wouldn't want to have an ever larger underclass of seething Americans with arsenals in their homes. I wouldn't want that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that some of these mass shootings have been deployed to, you know, affect that seizure of firearms.
Yeah.
I believe that.
Yeah.
We could go on, you know. I think the right has been right in emphasizing the importance of freedom, right? I readily admit this. Overall, I think that the so-called right is far more revolutionary, at least potentially, you know, in its attitudes and its intentions, than the so-called left, which is functioning, you know, the way the Red Guards function under Mao, it seems to me.
But it's been a complete flip. I mean, though I did not identify with every idea of the left, if you go down the list of my values, I'm opposed to this mass incarceration thing. I think that the borders should be open. I think that, which even most, you know, nobody wants to even admit this, I think that women should have complete control over their bodies. I'm against the death penalty. I'm against nuclear power. All of those values are consistent with what used to be considered the left. But suddenly,
right,
I have absolutely nothing in common with anyone who today identifies as left.
I'm completely with you on this. And I'm going to add a few positions,
yes,
at least of mine. I've always been fervently opposed to censorship, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've always been deeply distrustful of corporate power and have always believed that it should be restrained.
Mm-hmm.
I am a strong supporter of the working class, okay? The left hates the working class.
No.
They fetishize black people,
yes,
and Hispanic people, because they see everything through the filter of race. You know, they're identitarian in their politics, which is a kind of tribalism, right? Last but not least, right? We're anti-war.
Oh.
I mean, that's essential.
Yeah.
Right.
I missed that one as my first. My first.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm Quaker.
No, absolutely.
You know. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I spoke at a rally, protesting the indefinite detention of these scores of people who were swept up after the January 6th, quote, insurrection, end quote. That was another propaganda masterpiece.
Oh, what a
that
joke.
That was, like,
I mean,
a joke.
What a joke. I mean, I knew people from various sides of the political map who saw that, who were like, well, yeah, they did leave all those things laying around that could be used as ladders. And how does anyone get into the Capitol building unless the Capitol police lets them in? Have, like, you ever been there? The place is a fortress.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And then they're calling it an insurrection, when in reality, it was just a basically a kind of a randy protest that got in the door somehow. And one other last thing, by the way, my favorite photo that I was circulating to everyone was a photo of Nancy Pelosi walking from chambers to her office, surrounded by five guards, armed men, during the lockdown. So this Capitol is deserted. All that's floating around there are a couple of people from AP and the Washington Post and the New York Times. And she's got to walk from chambers to her office surrounded by five armed men. She's wow. security conscious. I have this somewhere. She's highly security conscious. You can't tell me she left her laptop out on the desk.
Yeah.
So yeah. The whole thing is, it is so mind-boggling, and yet, It takes special training to see this. It's not just easy to fool people.
That's the thing that has just staggered me, you know? And it has reinforced my conviction that you know, high school and college education, both of them need to be, I guess you would say, radically revised knowledge of what the U.S. government has done since World War II, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It tends to be dismissed as, deep state conspiracy theory. It's not conspiracy theory. People are calling that kind of rowdy intrusion. It wasn't even an intrusion because there's so much footage of Capitol Police ushering these people into the Capitol, you know, waving them in, opening
the doors. Hiding off to the side.
So,
opening
doors
and hiding off to the side.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what are they calling this? They're calling this an attempted coup.
Yeah.
Okay? Anyone who says that is bone ignorant of what a coup is. You want to talk coup? Let's talk about Chile in 1973. Mm. That was a coup. Let's talk about, Iran in 53 or Guatemala in 54. Those are coups where democratically elected leaders are arrested, the media is seized, there is violence, right? There is gunfire. In Chile, there was bombardment of the Capitol building, right? And Allende shot himself in the head, okay, rather than give up. That's a coup. They're calling this joke a coup? How stupid can you be? And it's not only that, Eric. There's something, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and make a speculation. I think some people who've been injected, I think there's something wrong with them, you know, because I have heard from several people after I sent to my listserv News from Underground, I sent out the piece that Tucker Carlson did on the FBI's direct involvement in that incident.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this was not conspiracy theory. He had on a guy who had the whole thing down cold. The FBI played a role in that incident, that attempted coup. And I just sent that out because, you know, the purpose of the listserv is to give people news that they're not getting elsewhere. And I heard from a few people who were so livid that I had sent this out that they told me not to contact them again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was kind of an insane reaction. And I'm not the only one who's noticed that some people who've been injected don't seem quite the same afterward, you know. So I lend credence to these suggestions that you know, one of the functions of this hydrogel, these nanoparticles that are included in the so-called vaccines, you know, maybe some kind of mind control. This is the kind of thing I never would have said a couple of years ago because it sounds batshit crazy.
Can I read you something from the Moderna website?
Please do.
Not Reddit. You know, I know the difference between Twitter and Moderna's homepage.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay. Our operating system. Here we go. Our operating system. I will link this. Recognizing the broad potential of mRNA science, we set out to create an mRNA technology platform that functions very much like an operating system on a computer. It is designed so that it can plug and play interchangeably with different programs. In our case, program or app, is our mRNA drug, the unique mRNA sequence that codes for a protein. We have a dedicated team of several hundred scientists and engineers working slowly on advancing, focused solely, excuse me, on advancing Moderna's platform technology. They're organized around key disciplines and work in an integrated fashion to advance knowledge surrounding mRNA science and solve for challenges that are unique to mRNA drug development. Some of these disciplines include mRNA biology, chemistry, formulation and delivery, bioinformatics, and protein engineering. But let's just go back to the first sentence here. It functions very much like an operating system on a computer. In our case, the program or app is the mRNA drug. And then they have a diagram that shows DNA, mRNA. DNA is the storage, mRNA is the software, and the protein are the applications. And they're designing what they call the software of life. That's it. Right up there. I haven't done this prank yet, but to put out a bulletin from Moderna saying you can play piano, you can have the Chopin upgrade, you can become a painter. You know, you always wanted to know world history? Come get our world history injection. If you've had the COVID shot, you have the operating system. Now you can be a historian. One injection.
Oh my God!
Tell me why that's a far-fetched idea. Someone tell me.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I had never read that. I had seen the Moderna, I guess he's the CEO, talk. Use the same terms in his, boastful presentations. Mm. I mean, can people not wrap their minds around the fact that Moderna has no history at developing vaccines? It's not really a healthcare company,
no,
at all.
Modified RNA, mod RNA, Moderna.
Exactly. So look.
So they're a genetic manipulation company.
That's exactly right. And here again is, another instance of a longstanding function in propaganda, or I should say a longstanding function of propaganda, now having been radically augmented and sophisticated through technological means, because propaganda has never been about persuasion. People mm-hmm. think that mass persuasion is a kind of synonym for propaganda. It is not. Mm-hmm. Persuasion is a kind of a social process that involves an active, antagonist or adversary, mm-hmm. as well as an audience whom you are trying to move through logical arguments and emotional appeals. But that's an embodied process involving people's minds, mm-hmm. okay? Propaganda doesn't do that. It doesn't mm-hmm. want that. It doesn't mm-hmm. want any other point of view even to pop up,
yeah.
right? It doesn't want to grapple with another side or an argument, a different argument. It wants any such argument to be inconceivable to people, mm-hmm. and it doesn't really appeal to the mind. Mm-mm. It appeals to the lizard brain. Mm-hmm. It has a kind of neural. It wants to work at the neural level. It just wants people responding, instantaneously and mindlessly. Yeah. And that's why it's always, tended to use the language of war, yeah. because it's based on arousing fear and anger. So that's what it has always wanted to do. Now, you've described a much more sophisticated approach where you just inject people with these tiny little receptors, right? And then you can kind of beam orders to them, and they will respond appropriately. It's beyond fiendish, You think of a Clockwork Orange, mm-hmm. It's like that, right? But without the fuss and muss of having to strap somebody in a chair and put lid locks on them, and have them associate nausea and a feeling of horror and impending doom with images of violence and sex. It's just much more efficient. And they've managed to pull it off by having people clamor for it. See, that's what's just mind-boggling about this.
Well,
as
they line
say,
up for it like
so
the new iPhone.
To fool people.
They're lining up for it like the new iPhone.
Yeah, that's right.
I couldn't that's understand right. that people. Oh, the iPhone 11 is coming out, and they should Manhattan people are lined up for three blocks to get the new iPhone 11. I couldn't really understand that. This now we understand.
Right.
It makes much more sense in the context of this whole scenario. And all they really had to do two things with this. Well, so along the trail of pursuing about 18 different issues in 2020, and making sure that I fulfilled my major goal of thoroughly understanding the polymerase chain reaction. I lost my train of thought there. Where were we? We were lining up for Apple, and then
right.
18 different issues.
18 different issues.
And then the polymerase chain reaction. Ah, a number of tactics used to persuade people, but this you will appreciate, I think. Along the way of doing all this, I came across a document from the Department of Homeland Security from approximately 2007, which was a summary memo of a psychogenic illness. And they gave four different examples, two in the United States, no, one in Japan, one in the United States, and two in Eastern Europe, where the mere news of a toxin sent people to the hospital with the symptoms of that toxin.
No kidding.
So here, yeah, I'll send you this thing. And so I'll give two examples. One was the sarin gas incident in the Tokyo subway.
Okay. Right.
And there was actual sarin, but it was contained to one subway station, right? You can't have one person spraying sarin gas and it spreads throughout the entire city and the suburbs. But the news spread, and then people started reporting, thousands of them, to hospitals with the physiological symptoms of sarin gas poisoning.
You mean people in Japan did?
Yeah, yeah. They had no possible means of exposure, but just the news report. A news report. This right, how long could that be in the news? A couple of days? Thousands,
right.
According to this DHS document, went to the hospital. In another incident, there was the wacky guy in the bank, ran into a bank in California and sprayed some stuff, whatever it was, deodorant or hairspray or nothing, and said, this is a chemical, you know, claimed it was some chemical agent. And everyone in the bank got sick, but there was no trace of any chemical or biological agent in the bank, whatever was sprayed. It was pure suggestion, and they all, many, I don't know if every down to the last person, but got biological, physiological symptoms of some chemical agent. And then they gave two other examples. I think one from Chechnya. I don't know those off the top of my head. Now, mind you, this was a very short-lived story, right? How much legs does the guy running into the bank story have? And that, to be fair, was people in the bank. But the sarin gas attack, that doesn't really, a week, maybe in the media, a week. Now think about COVID being broadcast 24/7 on every channel, every alternative channel, every newspaper, every website, every Twitter feed, everything from Newsy to cable to Spectrum News, bullshit Spectrum News, to every podunk little hokey in Peoria, you know, station in Peoria, to massive CNN, New York Times, Democracy Now, Fox News, Wall Street Journal, COVID, around the clock now going on 18 months. Well, of course they're going to get symptoms. And the only way to argue against that is to say, no, you're full of shit. But I've got the DHS document. On what grounds do we discount that summation?
No, that's really enlightening. You know, that's really significant. And that also dovetails with the remarkable disappearance of the flu, right? All last year.
Gone.
No more flu.
Cured.
That was gone.
Masks.
Right?
Masks cured it.
Yeah, masks cured it. Don't even get me started on that. I mean, masks.
Yeah.
I know, and it's
masks.
All looming. It's looming again, even as we speak. You know, L.A. is now going to reimpose the mask mandate.
Well, we'll see how that goes. But no one wants to hear that they don't work. I think that's interesting, or that the, you know, I try to describe. Well, you're talking about stopping a virus. Well, that's like trying to stop a gnat with a chain link fence. Nobody really cares about that. I'm just reading Reddit and love Trump.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And do I go into what's happened to me at NYU, or would you rather we just left that aside?
Woke culture came for you. I'll sum that up in the warm up.
Okay.
Let's stick to our subject because I know who you are, and I watched your story unfold with my eyes popping out of my head, and I'm one of these people who's very lucky to have had real professors when I went to university. I wear my SUNY Buffalo ring every day, proudly.
Yeah.
And I started a magazine at SUNY Buffalo, and these professors taught me. They sharpened my blade, and they took me in their home office and brought their boxes of artifacts from the 60s down to show me from the attic and all this. And I'm thinking, Jesus, what happened to academic freedom? When I was at UB, it was the right wing, so-called right wing back then, was going to be taping the lectures of the leftist professors and reporting them to whoever.
Right.
We just laughed. This is just a complete fucking joke. That you're really going to tape Charlie Haney's class and, like, what are you going to send it to, like, Lockheed Martin or something? And we're going to lose our metallurgy grant or, you know, laser beam grant from, you know, Bell. What the fuck? So now it's this left Gestapo. Now, here's the theory that I have, that I'm finding people are warmer to it than I had thought they might be. But, of course, I'm not giving this talk at a BLM rally. That the Me Too movement was a kind of a proof of concept for COVID. It's a thing where you create hysteria over a nondescript enemy whose behavior is impossible to characterize, and absolutely no proof is required, and you're guilty because you're accused, and any concept of validation of the claim or anything is in itself considered rape apology and all this stuff, and anything goes. And then just 2 years later, they roll out this thing which has stripping away the content now, right? Just looking at the medium, just looking at the structure, no proof required, a nondescript enemy, everyone must be afraid of the same thing. We all must agree, or we are pro-virus. I guess you're in favor.
We're
in favor of the virus. It to me, they are the exact same propaganda model on the front page of the New York Times every day for a year and a half, as if it was the world's only problem.
Well, that's right. That's what, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this lately because our mutual friend Celia Farber, you know, has noted long since that the whole HIV/AIDS thing was actually a kind of dress rehearsal for what we're going through.
Yes.
In that HIV would be, you know, invoked as a kind of death sentence based on misuse of PCR tests, right?
And antibodies test.
So they're all, right, exactly. All kinds of people would test positive for HIV and then be told, well, you're going to die, you know. And they made up the myth that heterosexuals were at grave risk of infection with AIDS, you know. And all it took was some test result, and nobody would really verify, you know, whether the test was valid or whether HIV actually does demonstrably cause AIDS all by itself.
Well, if and you questioned if you you would get shot down.
If you questioned it, exactly. You would be mauled, you know, as you wanted people to die. You're a horrible monster, you know. And that's, you know, you've just noted that's something that we see on many fronts now. Me Too, white fragility, you know, to be white is to be a white supremacist, and all it takes is somebody claiming that that's the case, you know, being accusing you. The accusation stands as proof. And it all works through propaganda, which, as you point out, always notes, obsessively notes, and thunders away, hammers away at one particular thing, right?
Over and over again, it is monomaniacal.
So in the Nazi propaganda, it was the Jew, right? The Jew, our misfortune. It was always the Jews. On the so-called left, it's Trump, right? COVID. Nobody died until COVID came along. Nobody died of anything else. And if you say they did, you want people to die,
yeah.
Right? Climate change, right? Is there any other environmental factor to worry about? Air pollution, water pollution, right? Fukushima, right? Mm. 5G? No. What's wrong with you? It's climate change. If you question whether or not that is actually true, well, you're a shill for the fossil fuel industry, right? It goes on and on, you know? It's always one particular thing, and people become instantly and militantly convinced that it is the key, it is the problem. And if you even argue with that, you are garbage. You're a Nazi. You know.
Yeah, you're a
Reddit reader.
You're one of them.
You're one of them, exactly. So you can't discuss anything. You can't talk about anything, right?
Now I don't remember things being this bad all my life. I'm 57, and so I had exposure to politics in the 70s. I remember Nixon resigning. I remember things happening, and I like to talk to old people, and I give good luck with professors. So I've seen a lot of history go by, and the only way that I can explain what's happening now is that we're under full digital conditions.
Well, yeah, that made it possible.
The tinderbox of that.
Yeah, that made it possible, right? Look, what the purpose of the lockdowns was, among other things, to atomize the population,
mm-hmm.
right? So everybody has to stay 6 feet apart.
Yep.
And
hide their faces, be afraid
hide
of
their
each
faces.
Other, not meet
that,
in
that's
public.
Right. Exactly. So freedom of assembly is nullified, right? Anyone who tries to exercise that right, except for BLM, they got to pass. But anybody else who congregates in protest or in worship or you name it, that's, you know, you want grandma to die, obviously. So everybody has to stay 6 feet apart, right? So they don't want us talking to each other. They certainly don't want us talking to older people, as you've pointed out. That's really important. And remember that in 1984, Winston Smith goes out in search of someone who will have a memory of what things were like when he was a child,
mm-hmm.
because he wants to know if what he's seeing all around him now has always been there, right? And he doesn't find anybody except some old drunk, you know, who is too, you know, foggy and half senile to help him out.
Yeah.
No one remembers. So they don't want us getting together and comparing notes. They don't want that. They want us not only staying 6 feet apart. This addresses your point. They also want us fully equipped with a smartphone, you know, because what we're not getting from other people, we're getting a kind of bogus. My syntax has gotten away from me. They don't want us talking to each other to compare notes. They want us absorbing whatever comes through the cell phone, which has all been sanitized by Facebook, sanitized by Twitter, you know, sanitized by Google, and even sanitized by Amazon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because some books are no longer available on Amazon or never were, you know, that raise certain kinds of questions. So you've got a kind, what this basically is, strictly speaking, is kind of fascist control of the media, because it is exerted by the combined forces of corporations and the state, right? So they now work together to make sure that we don't get any of what they call misinformation. They call it misinformation. It's usually accurate information, right?
Well, I have...
So in their eyes, you know, misinformation is any contradiction of the official narrative, right?
Yeah.
This
is like Soviet Russia and Maoist China. There is only it is packaged in the slick, shiny you know, friendly fascism, as has been called. It's this.
Yeah,
it is
right.
Slick and shiny, marketable, and we eat it up and we buy it. I have hanging over my toilet, along with my degree from UB, so I can look at it every day. I have my first ban from Facebook, where I quoted, I put up a quote from or an article by Dr. Richard Ebright at Rutgers, who's concerned about lab safety. Like, that's his whole thing. Long before COVID, he's a bacteriologist, molecular biologist, and completely accessible guy. And he gave me a quote, and I put up a quote in an article about him, and Facebook claimed that I was claiming that the coronavirus was lab engineered. I didn't even mention the coronavirus in my quote. I was just quoting Dr. Ebright.
Right.
And so it says, multiple fact checks from multiple fact checkers. The coronavirus was not engineered. We do not know where it came from, but it was not bioengineered. It did not escape from a lab. It did not do that. So I've got one step short of being framed. It deserves to be framed. And then, just like in 1984, one day Fauci says, oh, well, the lab escape theory is not so far-fetched after all. And I'm thinking, really? Really? And I got banned from Facebook. Oceania's always been the enemy.
right in the
middle of a sentence, they switch. You know, Eurasia's always been our enemy. So that's propaganda.
Yeah, that's propaganda. That's what we've been dealing with. That's what we should be teaching in our high schools and colleges, along with media literacy in general.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's something, you know, that I got in major trouble at NYU for doing.
Yeah, for
right?
analyzing this part, I especially love, right? You did it. You put the critique up on the lab examination table. Let's look at this as propaganda. Let's just consider.
Well, specifically, it was the mask mandates. All I did was suggest to the class that studying the mask mandates would be a most appropriate thing for us to do in a course on propaganda. This was an example. And I encouraged them to read, on the one hand, all the randomized controlled trials of masking in the hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, I thought there were 8. There are actually 10. They have all found that masks don't work. I urged them to read those, and I urged them to read the more recent studies finding otherwise. And I gave them tips on how to assess their soundness and said, you look at this and make up your own minds. That's what I said. And for this, you know, people can look into my story, but it is staggering that that was my thought crime. And for that, what's that?
Yeah, petitions raised,
made. Right.
And now you're tenured, you're full professor or associate professor? Doesn't matter.
No, I'm a full professor.
You're tenured full professor. I got that right?
Right.
Tenured.
You got it right.
Full professor at the New York University, one of the most powerful institutions in the world.
Yes, and probably more heavily invested in the vaccine industrial complex than any university. Surpassing even the University of Pennsylvania, which used to be the premier vaccine university. Now it's NYU, and I think that's the real reason why I came under woke attack, you know, by my department colleagues and one student. And there is a perfect example of how the corporate/state powers that be manipulate woke, I don't want to say anything insulting, but woke shock troops to get rid of, a pesky dissident who is making available to quite a small audience.
Yeah, yeah,
actually.
Class. How many 20 kids in the class?
Well, they didn't want me teaching the slaves to read in the classroom, that's for sure. But I think the real reason, the real reason they came after me was because of my online presence.
Yeah.
You know, I have a listserv of a few thousand people. You can join it at markcrispinmiller.com. I have a website, News from Underground, and I was doing a lot of interviews, you know, podcasts, shows like this. And am a COVID/vaccine dissident, you know, kind of a heretic.
We'll link this. We'll link this all up when for the, you know, we'll link this all up directly so you can jump right to it.
Right. But the important thing here, I'm suing my colleagues for libel, and I'm not suing NYU, but I speculate on pretty firm grounds that NYU is driving this thing because, you know, people should take a look at who's on the board of trustees of NYU.
Mm-hmm.
You can go online. It's huge. It's a huge board, but it has on it some of the biggest predators on the planet, you know. I mean, BlackRock is involved, right? China is involved. Abu Dhabi, it's pretty scary, and they have all kinds of heavy investments in big pharma, not a single academic. So I think that, you know, I did Catherine Austin Fitz's podcast, and she made the point that I'm really in the belly of the beast here, and she believes that since this whole reset is really, you know, the doing of the central banks, and it's all about the financial reset, you know, the elimination of cash, which speaks to your emphasis on digital technology.
Yep.
They're the ones who are really pulling the strings here, and they may well be ultimately responsible for my ordeal, right? I don't know. You know, I hope that we get discovery in the lawsuit so we might be able to see how the woke fanatics who came after me in the department were in conversation with higher interests. I have no idea.
Did you get past your motion to dismiss?
Still waiting for the judge to rule. This has been like 5 months.
Right.
They filed a motion to dismiss. All the documents are on my website. It's quite fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And we're waiting and waiting and waiting. Here it's mid-July. I am scheduled to teach in the fall. Let me add, by the way, Eric, that NYU, this is typical, has now announced that everybody in the so-called community, right, all employees and all students must upload proof of vaccination by, I think, next Thursday. And this includes even faculty who intend to teach remotely, as I do, because I don't want to get tested every week and I don't want to teach in a mask, right?
Mm.
So now, even if you're teaching remotely, you have to get the shot. Excuse me.
I understand why.
What is the...
Because you might catch a case of MN908947.3. This can, that's all they can test for. And this, the more I understand this, the better it gets. But it's the masking on Zoom meetings. Oh, come on, come on!
Yeah.
Like, I'm wondering why, like, just common sense doesn't engage at some point. Like, okay, we're supposed to be preventing a physical disease, but you've got a mask in a Zoom meeting.
Yeah, no, it is insane. The whole thing is insane. You know, masks, right? So somebody goes outside in a mask. This is at the height of it. And it will come back again, I think, when the weather turns colder. You go out in a mask, and if you see somebody without a mask on, you back away from that person. That's psychotic. You're basically saying that your mask doesn't work unless I wear one too. And that same illogic carries directly over into the so-called vaccination mandates.
Yeah.
Because time was, you and I can remember, it wasn't that long ago, a time when if you were vaccinated against a disease, you were serene about catching it. You didn't worry because you were vaccinated.
Yeah.
That doesn't work anymore.
No.
Now, if you're vaccinated, everybody else has to be vaccinated too, or it doesn't work. Okay, this is like beyond voodoo. This is insane. This is some kind of bizarre primordial fear.
Evocation.
Of there are people out there who are impure. And if they come near me, my protection against impurity will fail. Mm. My dad, by the way, is 95, God bless him, and he's in an assisted living facility in Chicago. Never had a flu shot in his life. He did not want the COVID shots, so he didn't get them. He's the only resident in that whole facility who hasn't been injected, and they're making him stay 6 feet away from everybody else. Can somebody explain that to me?
Yeah, it's punishment.
What are they afraid of?
Yeah. Well, I went to Foo Fighters at Madison Square Garden, the first full thing, injection only. I don't know if you heard my interviews. And I walked up and down the line, and I had one question, and I missed a good one, which is, why is it called Madison Square Garden if it's round? But I said, You're all vaccinated, right? Yeah. Cheers. They got the vaccination card around the neck. Would you feel safe if there was one unvaccinated person in the room? And I got a diversity of stupid answers. But I kept saying, my follow-up was, why, if you're all injected, why would it matter if there's one uninjected person? You're all supposed to be protected. And how could one uninjected person affect all 13,023, however many they sold tickets to? They didn't sell out. And Bruce Springsteen? Heaven help the martyrs whose papers are in order. That's a quote from Asbury Park, I believe. Heaven help the martyrs whose papers are in order, and you couldn't get into Springsteen on Broadway without your papers.
That guy is dead to me, I have to say. He's been dead to me for some time. Do you remember over the summer, last summer, on his show, his radio show, he said, Mr. President, put on a fucking mask, okay? Bruce Springsteen, right? The boss. What a tool this guy is. You know, stumping for Hillary Clinton. And I know there are people listening, well, not in your audience, but many people would say, oh, you must be a Trump supporter. You know, no, actually, I'm not. I can, you know, spot bullshit when I see it. And Bruce Springsteen is bullshit, like most celebrities, I'm afraid, you know, is the case. Celebrity has been completely weaponized against the, you know, human population of the globe. You can count on the fingers of one hand the celebrities who've had the brains and the balls to stand up and say this is wrong. You know, one of them is Eric Clapton, mm-hmm. God bless him, mm-hmm. and Van Morrison, and there's maybe two or three others. Where is everybody, you know? I mean, it's really scary.
Well, it makes you wonder, you know, what the force – there's some new force here, and I maintain – that it's digital, that this complete lack of any intelligence or rationality or the ability to ask a question, and moreover, the elimination of the concept of truth,
yeah,
gone, right? Well, you can prove anything with a study. Okay, that's true, but it doesn't make it one study never makes it true. But the elimination of the notion of truth entirely, if I believe it, it's true, is the rallying cry of the digital age.
Well, that's true, you know, along with the kind of ideological postmodernist, you know, rejection of the category of truth. So that gives a kind of intellectual gloss to this assumption, right? That there is no truth, mm-hmm. that it's true because I believe it. Mm-hmm. So there's a perfect confluence of the technological with an ideological thrust, if you see what I mean. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah. Well, yes,
feeling is the primary thing.
And there's
feeling.
No feeling in this feeling, by the way. There's no feeling in this feeling. It's a will-o'-the-wisp. It's a mere notion. If you're feeling,
right.
you're going to be disgusted by the fact that your grandmother is locked in a care home, long after the mandates are over, and there's still elderly people locked in these care homes and people can't even visit them. And you wonder why so many people over the age of 75 died last year, if they did indeed,
oh,
in numbers.
No, absolutely. As Denny Roncour has proven this,
yeah.
that the April spike, you know, in all-cause deaths among the old
was
clearly
lockdown.
Due. Yeah, lockdown. It was lockdown. No, you're absolutely right. The feeling that weighs, you know, the feeling that's important, that matters, the only feeling that matters is the feeling that the propaganda drive has aroused. It's only that feeling. It's only that fear, the fear of the virus, the
yeah.
fear of the virus.
Yes.
So what, you know,
yes,
what
yes,
about...
Yes, yes, yes. That's the feeling.
Say, what about
fear.
All the feelings of all the people who have been impoverished and immiserated by the lockdown? What about all the drug overdoses due to the lockdown, right? Mm. What about all the homicides and suicides due to the lockdown?
Domestic violence.
What about all
the
that?
Lockdown.
Right? What about the feelings of those little children made to wear masks and forced to go to school with teachers wearing masks?
Mm-hmm.
That is fucking grotesque. That's like some kind of occult ritual. Can you not feel that? No, that feeling is wrong.
Right.
That feeling is bad. That's not a feeling. That's just because you're a far right white supremacist, right? So it's really, I'm going to say it again. This is just an evil development. It's an evil development. Digital technology has certainly enabled it. That is its primary means of affecting this grotesque situation. But it derives from an elite whose intentions are as evil as their technological savvy is advanced, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's simultaneously highly civilized and yet deeply, deeply regressive, mm-hmm. you know. It's an impulse to power at all costs, you know. Mm. It's what Winston Smith learns from O'Brien. When O'Brien says to him, "We are different from all the oligarchies of the past in that we know what we are doing," right? The object of persecution is persecution. The object of torture is torture. The object of power is power, right? They understand. And they don't think in terms of some kind of master race. They don't believe in that mythology. They don't think in terms of the dictatorship of the proletariat. Mm. They know that was bullshit. They are perfectly disenchanted. They know what they want. They want to dominate everybody else. They want to dominate nature. That's what they want, and they're going to do it, right? And that's what we have now. That's what Bill Gates is. That's what they all are. It's the Rockefellers. The whole syndicate is all about that. They have too much wealth. They have too much power. It's wrong. It's destructive, and it has to be stopped. So, how in the short term, I don't know.
Well, what's the antithesis of this? And, we have to remain human. And as a kid listening, because I was involved in Holocaust studies at John Dewey High School as a high school student and was teaching young people, John Dewey was the Holocaust Studies Center for the city. And so all the elementary school students would file through our library and we'd show them the Allied footage and show them that the Holocaust happened. And by the way, you don't really feel it till you've put your hands in an ash pit at Auschwitz. We don't understand evil in our time. We do not believe it exists in the way that it can exist. And I think this is a big part of our problem. There's no orientation of what evil actually is.
Well,
you see those ash pits,
right,
man, it's a different thing.
Well, exactly. You're so right about that. I mean, I feel this keenly and deeply, this whole experience, I'm going to be perfectly honest about this. This whole experience has really acquainted me with the notion of evil, because I can't conceive of what's going on in any of the terms that matter. It's not just greed, it's not just trying to make more money. That's part of it. But it's evil. And this has moved me, to actually become a Christian, I identify as Jewish, I always have, and I still do, mm-hmm. but I don't really, personally speaking, I don't see how it's really possible to oppose this actively as necessary without actually joining the other side,
And it's a spiritual problem. And there's going to have to be a spiritual solution. It's not a political problem, a health problem, an economic problem, even a social problem. I think it's a spiritual problem.
I agree completely. I think that's what we're facing. We have to face up to it, this is a profound change for me, but I'm not the only one who said this. You and I are not the only ones who say this. I mean, a lot of people who've taken a really hard, deep look at what's going on have been shaken to the core by it. And the corruption of our most important institutions is absolute, it seems to me. And the professional classes are most to blame.
Most susceptible to this, and most to blame. The people who really understand and can actually critique the situation are not doing it. Most of them. Some are. Retired people, during the beginning, the thing that the dissidents coming out and saying, this doesn't make sense in terms of what they're saying it is and what it actually looks like, were retired people and people in private industry who could come forward, like Kevin McKiernan with the PCR Lab. PCR Lab, Massachusetts. David Rasnick, who's an independent biochemist, and independent journalists such as Rappaport, Celia Farber, myself. I have an astrology website, but I'm an investigative reporter. I've covered Monsanto. I started with Love Canal, so I'm like, I'm coming out of retirement. I've got to do the story. So it's all independent people.
It is independent people. The people who identify as part of any university or profession have completely failed. And it's not that different from under the Nazis, by the way. You know, almost all the doctors in Germany were on board pretty quick, and journalists were on board pretty quick, just like that, just like now. Working people are much more sensible in their responses to what's happening, much more skeptical, you know. But it's really something, you know, to see how many people, highly educated people, have completely lost, you know, all their reasoning ability, given in completely to the mythology out of fear and ignorance and self-importance, right? Because they think they're much too educated to fall for anything stupid. And yet, you know, they have perfect confidence in dismissing the kinds of things you and I are saying, things that are completely grounded in evidence, as conspiracy theory, you know? So it's sobering to see that people can revert to such a primitive state of mind, become so reactive, so fast. I don't think they're any different from the people hunting and burning witches, you know, in the 16th and 17th centuries. You know, if they were around when Galileo was, you know, subject to the Inquisition's scrutiny, they would have been on the side of the Inquisition, you know? They would have been on the side of the witch burners in Salem. I don't see the difference. I just don't. I don't see any progress whatsoever, you know? That's sobering to someone who spent years and years banging his head against the wall to try to alert the population to the necessity of real election reform, you know. I believe in democracy. I believe in electoral democracy. I still do. But it's sobering to see how subject people are to propaganda, especially when it's, you know, pumped into them nonstop from digital devices.
But they're disembodied. You know? This is where my understanding of what the McLuhans are really saying is that the people are transformed by the media environment prior to any content being relevant.
No, that's
so it's
true.
A special digital kind of a person.
That's right.
That's not going to hug somebody. And mind you, underneath all the digital, the invisible part of the environment is binary.
Yeah.
So
binary.
Hence the radical binary. Now that this country's been divided. Kennedy beat Nixon by 500,000 votes. Okay, that's pretty darn divided. But everyone grieved when Kennedy was shot.
Right.
We weren't that divided. Mark, thank you so much. You are welcome to come on the program anytime.
Well, that's good to hear, because I really enjoyed the hell out of this. it was great. It was really a great conversation. And, you know, I will definitely keep you posted on what happens with the suit, because it's, you know, the semester starts in about 7 weeks, and I still don't know what's up. I think my case is a flashpoint in a larger struggle, you know, for academic freedom and free speech.
Yes.
Not just about me, right? It's about all of us.
Better be.
So, you know, I want people to know about it, and, you know, we have to continue to work together to spread the word, however we may do it. And I'm, you know, glad you're on the radio. It's really refreshing.
And pretend internet radio. It's not, I'm not on terrestrial radio.
It's still, you know, it'll do for now.
But it's
now,
a carefully,
you know,
groomed audio format, free-form 70s, long-form interview. And hilariously, I am affiliated with Pacifica Network, and I jokingly call myself the Rush Limbaugh of the Pacifica Network. Some people get that joke and think it's funny. Because Amy Goodman, she's our flagship now, and she's like, one mask is love, and two masks is twice as much love.
Oh, she's a monster, okay? And I say this as someone who knows her, was on her show several times.
I've been on her show. And I had dinner with her. Yes, yep.
Yeah, yeah. We know these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But by their fruits ye shall know them. And her fruits are really poisoned. I mean, this is the, you know, she did a thing on vaccine apartheid, which she was deploring. But what she meant by vaccine apartheid was that the vaccinated were going to be at a disadvantage because the unvaccinated were going to put everybody at risk. This is war is peace.
Hallucination. War is peace. Yeah, freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. They're
right.
Tripping. Well, one last McLuhan quote. Marshall said, the computer is LSD for the businessman. I think
that's
the computer
really
is LSD for everyone. I think everyone's tripping balls.
Right. Well, let me counter that with another of his
statements,
which I'm sure you know it, but you know, I may mangle the first part of it, but it says that the little lies can be disproved, but the big lies are protected by public
incredulity.
That's
right.
That's absolutely right.
And this is out of Mein Kampf. It's out of Goebbels. There's a playbook for this, but the thing that electrical media does is it unravels literacy and it creates tribalism.
Yeah.
And so we're not only seeing the effects of what's injected, what we might defend ourselves with is that structure, that intellectual structure in nearly everyone no longer exists.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. It has done that.
And he said it would. He said it would. And this, the Global Village is radio.
Right.
Where there's no privacy and everyone's in each other's tits and there's no more individual.
Yeah. Well, you know, the original title of 1984 was The Last Man in Europe, right?
Oh, I did not know that.
That book is so chilling because it ends with the extinction of the one remaining human subject, you know, still capable of longing, still struggling to remember what was true and what wasn't, you know.
Yep.
And at the end, he loved Big Brother.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that book is the most prescient and important book in modern history. You know, it is vastly more useful than Capital, right?
Yeah.
But now that we're faced, as you said, with a new world order that means communism for all of us down at this level, right? You will have no privacy, you will own nothing, and you'll never be happier. That's like, you know, Maoism to the max.
You'll eat
for
worms
us.
And you'll like it.
You'll eat worms and you like it. So we'll be living as if under communism. But the system above our level is a fascist system. It is a state corporate combination, right, that exerts total power over us.
Yeah.
So it's fascism at the top and it's communism at the bottom, unless we stop it, right? And we will. I'm not sure exactly how, but we will. You know,
we're
and it's going to come
having
from
these conversations. I do this as long as I can.
Yeah, yeah. God bless you for that.
And we're going to have these conversations, and I'm going to talk to everybody that I see on the street, and everybody, and I do this all day long, and I'm asking the people why they're wearing a mask, and all day long. This is, not to the point where it gets like irritating. I try to have some fun with it, and I do. And then they get a card. They get a card for the program. And every now and then, I have a pleasant surprise. And I find out when I said to a server in a restaurant today in Woodstock, a place where I'm about to put out one of my parodies, claiming that the town board has extended the COVID mandates out to like 21:37, because that's how it is in Woodstock. And I said to this young woman, so I take it you're wearing that mask because you're not vaccinated. She said, that's right. I won't take that thing. And I have had several of those conversations Over,
oh, that's great.
You know, so they have not gotten to everyone, but we don't know yet how to really grab each other and hold hands and focus our resources. So we'll learn We've got a lot to learn. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right. No, I was just agreeing. And I think it's harder for those of us who are in blue areas. You know, it's harder. I think it's easier. I was just in Idaho for a couple of days, and it's like another world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not a single mask, except I glimpsed a couple at the pharmacy section of a Walmart, but nowhere else, you know. I mean, I now cherish the tradition of hardy individualism.
Mm-hmm.
That's been, you know, heavily demonized as, you know, fascistic and predatory and blah, blah, blah. But no, that's where the resistance is going to come from. It's going to come from the parents of vaccine-injured children. It's going to come from Christians, you know, and from those of us who still doggedly identify as part of the left that was, right,
mm-hmm.
but who are now politically marooned. Because the self-described left is a weapon
morose.
Against humankind.
Look, they're morose. Okay, so I live a block away from the county courthouse. So when the march comes by to the courthouse, comes by my house, and then I grab my camera and run and look at all these angry and sad eyes wearing masks. Now I got to have dinner with Bobby Seale. Once.
Okay.
It was one of the greatest experiences of my entire life. I there should have been somebody with the oxygen mask. I was laughing so hard at his personal telling of the Chicago 7 and the Chicago 8. We were treated to that because someone at a National People of Color Caucus made a racist comment that me and my girlfriend were in the room, and Bobby said, well, that wasn't necessary. So when after he said that, I thought I'd introduce myself after he spoke, and I was treated to dinner with my girlfriend and him and one other person. We laughed for an hour and a half, and then I was involved with MOVE. I covered Mumia Abu-Jamal, and I hung out with MOVE people, all of whose friends and family had been shot and or burned to death and or children burned to death by Mayor Wilson Good and put in jail for 99 years, and they were joyous people. We could laugh.
Wow.
We had fun. Those marches were completely multicultural, and people were celebrating to get Mumia Abu-Jamal, alleged cop killer, out of jail. Fun. And then I went to the benefit concert at Brendan Byrne Arena with Rage Against the Machine and the Beastie Boys. This was fun. The press conference was fun. The concert was fun. And it was not that it lacked for seriousness or understanding of the gravity of the issue, but we were together and celebrating. And what I see missing from the social movements of today is any humor, any joy at all. It's like, well, without loving the dream, it ain't going to come true.
No, that's really well put, you know. And that's what made the 60s, you know, with all its limitations.
Yes.
Such a joy, you know. I mean, that was my generation. I'm a generation older than you,
mm-hmm.
and I remember that vividly. You know, mm-hmm. that you cannot really separate. I mean, there are some purist arguments against the counterculture, and some of them, you know, have merit, but you can't really completely separate the marvel of 60s music, you know, from the political spirit of that era.
No.
You know, it was a glorious time.
Yes.
You know, it was really inspiring and such a relief, you know, after the 50s and so on. The kind of grimness and grayness of that era was supplanted by an explosion that was really something wonderful. Now, we didn't really appreciate the significance of the Kennedy assassination. It took me decades to get back to that moment and see how it really inaugurated the move toward what we're living through now,
yes.
right?
Yep.
His murder, his brother's murder, Malcolm's murder, and King's murder, and Fred Hampton's murder, right? These were all, the purpose of all these killings was in part...
And John Lennon?
To prevent any... Well, John Lennon, too, was to prevent any kind of... mass unity, right? Because those four figures in different ways, and Fred Hampton too, in his local way, we're all working to bring different groups together, right, across racial lines, across, ethnic lines. And that could not be tolerated. You know, that's the most dangerous thing you can do now, mm-hmm. is to talk about alliances mm-hmm. across the board, mm-hmm. right? Because division is their primary tactic, divide and conquer. It was true under the Romans. It was true under the British. It's true today under globalism. They want to divide people. And that's why woke ideology is so useful to them, mm-hmm. because it's tribal, right? It's mm-hmm. identitarian. No common interests. If you talk about common class economic interests, you're accused of racism, right? So that's what we have to do. We have to get back to that, and we have to reclaim that sense of fun, as you say. By the way, have you seen Judas and the Black Messiah? Have you seen that movie?
I have not. What year?
Oh, yeah, see it. Please see it. That's about Fred Hampton, right? Mm. And the traitor, you know, in his midst, the Judas, William Coleman. It was nominated for an Oscar. It is staggering. What an achievement that movie is. You know, the fact that it was made at all, because it really honors the true radicalism of Fred Hampton's mission. Mm-hmm. And you compare that to the trial of the Chicago Seven by Aaron mm-hmm. Sorkin, in which Fred Hampton makes a brief appearance as a solemn, glum BLM guy before the moment of BLM, you know. The contrast between these two movies couldn't be greater or more instructive. But do yourself a favor and see the first, because it's really something. It's really something to recommend.
I saw the recent Chicago 7 movie.
Yeah, I'm talking about that as a bad example.
Right. Well, yeah. The one thing that I was impressed by that was I didn't realize, even though I heard the story from Seal himself, that he had nothing to do with any of this. He was just swept in as a way of spreading the paranoia. But the thing that Bobby told me that I remember the most vividly from that conversation, besides being found and gagged and charged with 16, convicted of 16 counts of contempt for defending himself in federal court, was he said they weren't worried about our shotguns or law books, our tape recorders, our following the police. The thing that made the powers that be nervous about the Black Panthers was the breakfast program. Across the country, hundreds of thousands of children, black children for the most part, being served free breakfasts every day. He said that's when they shut us down.
Yeah, that absolutely follows, right? That absolutely follows.
Scrambled eggs.
That fact just sort of disturbed the propaganda narrative that these guys were all about guns and killing white people. Mm-hmm. You know, they were a hate group.
Yeah.
The miracle of Fred Hampton was that he was actually organizing Appalachian whites and Hispanic street gangs along with the Panthers and black street gangs. See, that's the kind of organizing and bridge building that they won't tolerate, right? And that's what scared the shit out of J. Edgar Hoover, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, all this is in the movie. It just, I can't believe it, you know, because I've always believed that movies can do a great deal to help people, you know, come to understand history and politics, you know, even some major Hollywood movies mm-hmm. like Godfather Part II, you know, Chinatown, mostly movies from the 70s, you know, are really, really sophisticated politically, you know, and here's a movie that just came out that's in that same tradition. So, you know, I teach film as well as study of propaganda, so...
I would love to meet you for lunch. Are you meetable for lunch? May I come down? And
sure. Good. We're going to be spending 2 weeks in Maine starting this weekend, but I'll be back after that, and I'm always available.
Good. Thank you. Can I end on a positive note?
Yeah, please do.
I have learned in my long career doing this kind of thing, and from the study of history, and from being involved in things myself, that you don't know how weak your opposition is until you push back. And they always, whoever they are, they always present themselves as being intractable and all-powerful and all-knowing, and that's it. You've been squashed like a bug. Until they fold, until they throw their cards down and walk away or settle the case. So it is worth it to keep... to persist. And the argument for fun is the only way you can persist with any sustainability is by love and loving what you're doing and having fun doing what you're doing. And so the fun part is absolutely essential to the entire the ecosystem of success and of working together. It's got to be about actual celebration and love. And I don't know who's going to win, lose, or draw in this one. No one's ever succeeded at conquering the human race, but
no, right.
I would say let's go. Let's keep going. It's game on, so let's play. Mark?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mark?
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Eric. We'll talk again soon.
Hold on. I'm going to just stop the recording.